The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. Welcome to Secure in Mind. I am here in London with Kieran Martin. Very excited for this. Kieran Martin is the CEO for the National Cybersecurity Centre, something that we'll discuss in more details during this podcast. So I'm going to hand it over to Kieran. And initially, as the podcast always tries to explore the human behind the policy, he'll give a bit of detail as to who he is, how he got into this position, and then we'll get into the guts of it about what we're doing to fight cybercrime. So welcome, Kieran.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too. So first of all, tell us a bit about yourself, how you got to this position. And let me preface this by saying when I had a great discussion with Neil Walsh, who's the head of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and there was a real personal factor that got him motivated to ascend to the position, which drew from a childhood incident, actually. But you don't have to go that deep. Maybe just tell me a bit about why you're in this position.
I don't have any stories of those kinds, but I think a motivating factor that endures to this day and has endured every day is the belief in upholding free societies. And if you think about the internet and the impact that it's had, it didn't invent the Western liberal democratic values, but it sprang from them. Mm. And we had the sort of idealistic phase of the internet, if you like, in the late 90s and 2000s. And I think as technology has matured and become more ubiquitous, we're now dealing with some of the darker sides of it, and we're dealing with models of the internet that are designed to be less free, they're designed to exploit weaknesses, and they're designed to harm us. And so it's very motivating when you think about the power of modern technology. It's very motivating to be involved in securing that. Mm. I'll probably touch on this a bit later, but our philosophy here isn't to do security for its own sake. It's to do security to allow people to live free, happy, productive digital lives, and to do just enough to do that. In terms of myself, you might say I'm an unlikely figure to have ended up in this type of environment. I'm not technical by background. I'm a liberal arts graduate, a history from Oxford 23 years ago.
And national cybersecurity makes complete sense.
So I joined the civil service in 1997, the UK civil service, long before anybody was talking about cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. I had a career initially in finance and the treasury, but then I moved into national security policy. There were some very difficult issues arising from challenges to activities in the post 9/11 period and in the Iraq conflict and so forth. And it brought our intelligence services into a whole new realm of scrutiny, a whole new realm of legal and policy challenges and so forth. And I became involved in that. And through that, I got to know the intelligence services quite well. And in late 2013, Sirian Lobban, who was the director of GCHQ at the time and who I did know well and had an enormous amount of respect and admiration for, said that he was looking to refresh his top team from the and was interested in blending some of the experts that were already in the top leadership from within GCHQ with those with more outside experience. Mm. And there were two reasons for that. One was just after the Snowden leaks crisis. And so GCHQ, which had been, I think, more shielded from some of the scrutiny challenges of the previous decade than, say, MI5 and MI6, was now facing probably the greatest level of public scrutiny and indeed crisis in its in our 100 years of history. Mm. But the other point was that on a slower burn, if you like, cybersecurity was rising up the agenda, and GCHQ had always been the information security arm of government, but there was a desire to really make it kick on and be more active and successful in that space. The first thing I said to Ian, when he dangled the job and potential job in front of me, was, "But I'm not a technologist." And he said that GCHQ was full of deep technological experts, and what he was looking for was somebody to try to brigade the policy, the strategy, the money, the influence, put it on a firmer footing, and in a sense allow the expertise that was within GCHQ to flourish for much greater national good. And so somewhat nervously, given the fact that I didn't have a subject background, I took the job on that basis. I've never regretted it. He was right. He was true to his word. There were fantastic people here, an absolute wealth of expertise. But there were some real challenges. I mean, we got past the Snowden period, and I think that reflected the fact that the integrity of the organization was so strong. And so when we were challenged, I think, and when people did look underneath the surface of the activities, they were lawful and they were ethical, and we kept the public trust. On the cybersecurity side, there were really deep-seated challenges. We had a very deep and rich understanding of the threat because we're a world-class secret intelligence organization. We're much less good at using it because we're a secret intelligence organization. So because of that...
the catch-22 there.
So because of that, we started to think, and Ian, the three directors I've worked for, Ian Lobban, Robert Hannigan, and now Jeremy Fleming, have all given me the space with my team, with the likes of Ian Levy, Paul Chichester, Claire Gardner, and so on, and Nikki Hudson. They've given us the space to really think through some of those issues, and so I'm sure we can touch on this a bit later. But I think for the first time in a career in government bureaucracy, I was given the freedom to think radically and to use expertise.
That's a good place to be.
It's a fantastic place to be.
Do you think, I guess just as an aside before we get into the details about what the National Cybersecurity Centre does, do you think as a result of those Snowden impacts and then the post-Snowden impacts, we looking under the covers and seeing that everything was set in place and was judicial, etc., is that the reason why there's sort of more interface now with the public and, you know, coming out? This is your first podcast, for example, in trying to show what we're doing or what you're doing?
I think it's the second and less important of two reasons. The primary reason we're more open is that cybersecurity requires it. Again, at that time in my first year, my first full year, I started, having got the job in late 2013, I started in February 2014.
Whirlwind.
The operations, I remember the operations side, and we'd go to senior ministers and we'd say, look, here's a new intrusion from country X. And, and it would be this great piece of intelligence, great piece of technical analysis. But if it was aimed at the corporate sector, it would be very difficult to transmit that information in a way that the corporate sector could use it. We needed to advise people. But an organization that was several hundred feet of barbed wire, with no mobile communications, with no wireless internet-facing communications allowed in it, it was a pretty hard way to communicate with. So that was the main reason why we became a bit more open. I mean, people talk about cybersecurity as a team sport, and they're right. So, if you go back to that philosophy about we just want to make things safe enough for people to live happy and safe digital lives, we need to tell them things, and so we need to be good at communication. So that's why we're out in the open. I think this, the impacts of the Snowden leaks were a secondary issue, but I think if you look at what's happened in intelligence services in Western democracies across the world in this century, you have a whole range of phenomena that go beyond one leaker. They go they go to the fact that, you know, 21st century societies are less automatically trusting of government institutions, including secret institutions, than 20th century societies. So you have to do a bit more. And I think one of the things we learned from that period was you can talk a lot about the operating environment and the way you do things and what you learn from them. Even in very sensitive issues like counterterrorism, so you can talk a lot about how and why you do things without talking about what you actually do and the specific and the specific casework. And whether it's the national cybersecurity side of GCHQ or the rest of it, public trust absolutely matters. You can tell a lot more about what we do from open source than you can about the rest of GCHQ. But at the same time, I think, we need to find ways of telling the public that we know what we're doing, we're competent, but we know how to do it properly and well, that we're ethical, and I think we've made great strides in that respect.
Yeah, I do too. So let's get into it.
Okay.
National Cybersecurity Centre. It's a part of, it sits underneath GCHQ, but if you can sort of explain the structure, what you guys, what the main purpose of it, etc., that'd be great.
So, to answer it in a slightly different way, if you don't mind, the government decided in 2015, there was an election in 2015, Conservatives won it, and they said, right, amongst other things, they said, we're going to take cybersecurity really seriously. Mm-hmm. And they looked at, they looked not just at structures, because we'll come on to structures, but people get fixated on structures. Actually, the important thing for me was strategy.
Okay.
I went to a dinner at one of the cybersecurity conferences in Georgetown, Washington, D.C., at some point in that year, I can't remember exactly when. And I remember there was an excellent speaker who went through the history of U.S. public policy. It was very similar to U.K. public policy. So said, you know, talked about how, you know, the previous strategies have been about encouraging information sharing in the private sector and government and industry partnership. And that's exactly what our strategies were. And then in conversation, I remember recounting with other, you know, allies, yes, we've all done these strategies, and all government strategies in the West since about 2005 have been tell the private sector to share more information and to work with government. And the mood in 2015 was that we should try that again. Only this time try it a bit harder and work a bit harder. And there was something, again, because we had the freedom to think a little bit radically, there, there was something for us about thinking, hang on a minute, let's think about doing something
maybe slightly different.
Let's not repeat the same strategy. Because some of it had been really successful. You know, we'd all built up very good capabilities against the, some of the biggest state threats. But I think in that sort of mass marketplace of just how safe was the digital environment, we hadn't been nearly as successful. You know, information sharing hadn't solved everything. It hadn't picked up. And so on. So we started to think about things differently. So as well as the tech of cybersecurity and the operations of using GCHQ to find out what was the, you know, what the big threats were.
Yep.
We did a lot in two areas. One's economics and the other's behavioral science.
Okay.
So if you take economics, we started to think about, there's a massive global cybersecurity industry out there. It's really, really good at what it does. There's lots of really big companies with massive budgets for cybersecurity, and their senior executives are taking it really seriously. So why is the internet still riddled with vulnerabilities and structural flaws and so on? We started to look at some of the economics. So spoofing was a big example. And very quickly, we worked out in terms of economic analysis that, I mean, spoofing is a ubiquitous feature of cyber vulnerabilities. You know, pretty much any cyber attack, whether it's the most sophisticated state actor or, you know, the proverbial teenager in a bedroom, is, a cyber attack will involve one entity sending a message of some sort to another entity saying, you should trust me, and I'm asking you to believe I'm someone that I'm not. Or I'm something that I'm not. So it's a huge sort of societal and internet infrastructure problem. But if you take the big British retailers, for example, or big British government departments, when we studied their experience, they suffered no damage from being spoofed. So they had no incentive to do anything about it. Quite rationally, in terms of human behavior, a customer of Britain's biggest high street stores would not blame the store if someone sent them a spoof email pretending to be them. They wouldn't say, well, I'm not shopping at these people anymore, but even though I've shopped at them for 20 years and I really like them because I got a spoof email from them. And we work very closely with the tax department, who were, I think at the time, the 16th most spoofed brand in the world.
The actual tax department was.
Her Majesty's Revenue Customs in the UK was the 16th most spoofed brand in the world. And you would do these things. You do these conferences and with, say, 100 people.
Yeah.
And you'd ask them, how many of you have had an email offering you a tax refund?
Hands
and, you
know, go up.
99 hands would go up, and the 100th person is probably asleep. So we said, well, what can we do about this? And that's when we got the DMARC protocol, and we, you know, updated it, modernized it, pushed it out there, started using it. And, you know, the famous story in our world where, you know, the way that worked was emails that pretended to be from HMRC were sent to us, not to the intended recipients. And we got 500 million of them in the first in the first full year. And I think now HMRC is the 146th most spoofed brand, not the 16th. So, you know, it was a real impact. Yeah. So we did things like that. On behavioral science, we looked at, well, why are, you know, we're shouting at people. Mm. We're telling them you're doing this wrong. You know, highly sophisticated people are telling us that they can't use saying, oh, I really struggle with this stuff and I can't use my phone securely and all the rest of it. Well, hang on, that's our fault. Mm. You know, that's not the fault of the user. These are highly competent people doing highly impressive things in everyday life, but they can't use this. That's the problem's not with the individual.
Yeah.
It's with somebody else. So, I mean, password guidance is the other sort of classic. You know, password guidance worked on the assumption where, you know, it's for the benefit of the network owner. So I own this network and you want on my network.
Yep.
So I'm going to make it really difficult for you to get on my network so that I can protect my network.
Yep.
And that's fine. But for you, you've got 25 of these in your professional and personal life. And so you've got 25 different onerous requirements.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work, so we changed that.
Yeah.
And all that. So there's a big thing about strategy where we were more activist, and we were more activist in that sort of what we call commodity area.
Yep.
You know, this protects you. It does protect you against some of the state threat stuff because we don't make the most sophisticated actors work hard enough.
Yeah.
But it protects you from some of the ubiquitous transnational cybercrime as well. So we wanted to change strategy to be more activist. So we wanted to be able to make those interventions. We wanted to be able to publish more data, which required sort of, if you like, a policy change. We wanted to be able to have a mandate to go into some of the critically most important networks as they were updated and so on. So we changed from just saying, oh, let's take a fairly, I mean, to be honest, it was a fairly passive government cybersecurity approach, which was, let's just look after the things we care about most through an elite national security organization in GCHQ, and let's try and do some activities to encourage the private sector to take care of the rest.
Mm.
That was the old strategy. The second one was much, much more activist.
Yeah.
So the National Cybersecurity Centre flowed from that. It was, you know, structures followed strategy, where things right rather than the other way around.
Yep.
So it was, well, what do you need for that? And essentially, there are two models, we're trying to be a hybrid. We're trying to be the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at, say, Five Eyes countries pre-2015 and the US to this day, essentially cybersecurity is run out of, you know, specialist national security organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at continental Europe, it's run out of standalone, and it's run out of, in Five Eyes, it's run out of, you know, SIG and signals intelligence organizations.
Mm-hmm.
On the, you know, time-validated assumption that, you know, those who have to attack other networks in the interest of national security also have very good insights into how to defend them and what the threatening actors are up to. In continental Europe, there tends to be, by and large, a different model. We've got a standalone information security agency, which works closely with the national security agencies, but falls outside them. And we tried to do both. In the UK, in the last few years before the NCA set up, we had our CERT, our Computer Emergency Response Team, and that was in one of the sort of non-national security departments and was outside, if you like, the secret world. And then GCHQ was to look after the sort of top end of the threat.
Sure.
As I've already said, the problem for GCHQ was we didn't know how to get our threat data out, and we didn't know how to get our expertise out. The problem for CERT UK was it didn't have access to it in the way that it did. So the challenge for CERT was, what can you get of your own from your own? What can you get from this part of low classification government that you couldn't say buy from Symantec, for example?
Yeah.
So the NCAC is to try and do both at the same time.
Mm.
So. What can you get from if now that we've built, you know, these mechanisms, we've moved this part of GCHQ to central London to a big open area. I know it's audio, so people can't see it, but you're surrounded not by barbed wire but by glass, looking out over London.
Kieran is pointing at a beautiful view of London.
we have our phones on the table. You know, we can in a crisis we can talk to anybody in the world at any time, whether that's industry, media. Victims and so on. We can be really responsive.
Yeah.
We can have industry experts in here all the time without doing onerous security clearances because they're in a low classification environment.
Mm.
So we can do all that. but so can a good cybersecurity company.
Yeah.
What we've also got then, because behind us we can see a screen that says National Cybersecurity Centre, a part of GCHQ. Within, you know, a few, within less than a minute, I could be in a very secure, classified environment with access to data that no one else has.
Yep.
That's not just our data, it's data from the Five Eyes partners, you know, wonderful, wonderful partners. Mm. It's data from all over the world, it's data from industry. It's highly specialized skills from people who really have a passion for national security, for the mission, if you like. So it's access to those data capabilities and skills that the private sector doesn't have, but then turned into a usable form for everyone. So one of the moments I was proudest of in 2018, if you look at the NCSC website at ncsc.gov.uk, you will see a very dry duo of publications, one in April, one in October, jointly with the US and the Australian government. And they're both called something like Indicators of Compromise of APT 28, Russian APT 28.
Yep.
These are the attributions of sustained Russian intrusions into critical national infrastructure networks. They were ongoing intrusions, so it wasn't just a retrospective attribution. Mm-hmm. It was it's something, you know, these are ongoing. So you, by publishing the Indicators of Compromise, a business, anybody, can just look online and say, I can run these through my system and see if they're there, and if they're there, I can get rid of them.
Yeah, and if they were there, then they would contact you and then get assistance to get rid of them, or vice versa.
They don't even have to. I mean, you know, some of it's fairly technically straightforward.
Yep.
The reason I cite that example is that I asked somebody who'd been around much longer than I had, I said, this data in this Indicators of Compromise publication, if this had been 10 years ago, what classification would that data have been? It said, at least top secret, you know? And now there it is on the internet.
Yeah.
And we can use this, and it's safe. I mean, it's not, we haven't done this recklessly, we've done it extremely carefully.
Yeah.
But cyber data does lend itself to publication in a way that perhaps some other intelligence data doesn't.
Does not,
and it needs to, because people need to use it. So in a fairly small, in 1.5 floors of a London commercial tower block, we can do everything from the sort of public education, the industry workshops, you know, the spreading best practice, all the way through to some of that top secret attribution, and we can do it in the same place.
It all sounds really fantastic. Well, I personally have a much better understanding as well, and I'm sure the listeners will. Going to your interface with public business, how has that been received? And also the education, not just for business, but also for citizenry, some of the communications as well. Are they being well received? Are they being? Do you get some good feedback?
I hope well. It's a work in progress. I think we're 850 or so people.
Yep.
So we have to do a one-to-many function. So it's a country of 66 million people or so. There are about 3.3 million registered businesses. So we obviously can't talk to everyone.
Yep.
But we've had for around a year now, we've had a small business guide, which, again, really quite proud of this, because in the old days, the way we talked to small business was the way we talked to sort of massive Leviathan sort of multinational corporations.
Yep.
Who can't afford this stuff. You know, they can't afford to have some state-of-the-art, you know, US or, you know, big European cybersecurity provider for hundreds of millions of pounds or whatever these sort of contracts are. And they've no need for them either. So, you know, what is a small business with, you know, let's say data heavy, what do you need to do that? What about a small business that's got one core bit of really good intellectual property? What do they need? So we've done things there. Later this month, a senior cabinet minister is planning to launch our board toolkit, which is guidance for, you know, it's aimed at larger organisations, but really, really practical. I think, again, we're trying to move on from the old days. About 5 years ago, you might say that our advice to companies was that they should manage risk well, which I'm sure, you know, they'd thought of already.
Great.
We're trying to say to them, do you know what a phishing attack is and how would you cope with one? And don't tell us. And then we sort of walk them through it to say, the answer is not only phishing your own staff to see how many of them click on it, because nobody's ever got a zero click rate.
Yeah.
It's assuming that the click rate is greater than zero. How are you going to manage it? How are you going to cauterize the damage? How are you going to make sure that the people who click on the link are not the most vulnerable and they're not the network administrators and so on? So we've done quite a lot of that. And we've done quite a lot with the big sectors, you know, the big critical sectors. We intervene directly there, but we also intervene with the lead government departments and the regulators. So we've got an excellent partnership with, for example, the Bank of England, our central bank, which is also the financial services regulator, where they've taken a very clever approach, which is they've got a mandate from Parliament, a law, to say it is your duty to safeguard financial stability. They've interpreted that as including cybersecurity. So they've come to us they were one of the reasons we were set up. It was the governor of the bank saying to the government, I want to talk to the cybersecurity experts, and where do I find them? And they said, well, they're sort of scattered all over different functions. So it was, you know, put them together in a single place where they can talk in the open rather than in secret.
Yeah.
And so we bake good cybersecurity into the financial regulatory system.
Yep.
So it is a work in progress. I would like, so at the top end, I would like, you know, the sort of exemplary nature of the of what we do in the finance sector to be replicated across wider critical sectors. I think for business as a whole, I hope the board toolkit is seen as a transformative innovation. I think a big challenge for us, which we haven't cracked yet, is then the individual.
Yeah.
You know, we're also this month launching a revised website. I think whilst, you know, we're very proud of what we've done online so far, and that we've been, you know, the fastest public authority in the world during some of the major data breaches to get advice out to our own citizens. I think one thing when we tested it with users was, you know, this is easier to navigate if you're highly technical than it is if you're just somebody who's interested in cybersecurity. So again, we're now trying to do both. So the new website, you know, has various buttons that say, right, I think it's got six, and one extreme is I'm a private individual who just wants to know about how to secure my iPhone, or whatever, secure my online savings. The sixth button is I'm a cybersecurity professional.
Okay.
And then you get content.
And then you get the good stuff.
Yeah. Well, you get, okay. You know, there will always be stuff on our website that is designed for most people not to understand because it's highly technical.
Yeah.
But I think we need to make sure that we guide people more clearly to things that anyone can understand. It's interesting. If you look at when we had the WannaCry crisis in May 2017, which is probably our biggest operational challenge, we put three pieces of advice out on the Sunday morning, the crisis having started on the Friday.
Mm-hmm.
One was designed not to be understood by most people. It was, you're a network administrator.
Mm.
What's this patch look like? What do you need to run? What do you need to download? What do you need to install?
Mm-hmm.
The second bit of advice was for organizational leaders. So, you know, you're the CEO and we're assuming you're not technical. What do you need to ask the first guy? And the third one was for everybody.
Mm.
And it was the sort of never waste a good crisis. So ransomware, here's what ransomware is.
Yeah.
And there were three pieces of advice, the third of which I always remember because it was, I think, very powerful. It was ransomware. If you have a backup of your data, ransomware doesn't work because you can't be held to ransom if you've got a backup. Anybody can understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very good example. I would also like to know, when you're talking about WannaCry, a breakdown of the types of threat actors and their motivations. And I guess this sort of splits into different categories. The public hears on this small 2-minute sound bites that you've got country X and country Y, and then you've got cyber criminal. Who are they? What are they doing? And how are they doing it?
Sure. So let's start with the top end of the threat from nation states. The UK government has over the past 2 years attributed cyber attacks against the UK to four countries.
Mm-hmm.
Russia. Our analysis of Russia has tended to be, this is traditional statecraft by new means. So it's for geopolitical advantage, it's for espionage, it's for what we call in the trade prepositioning. So in case of heightened tensions, they will have presences on networks that could then be the basis for further exploitation. They don't activate them. But if you look at, for example, Russian cyber aggression in Ukraine, you see quite a lot of what it can look like when used in anger.
Yep.
Last December, the government, the foreign secretary, attributed hostile activity to China for the first time. That was fundamentally economic in nature.
Mm-hmm.
It was compromises of major managed service providers. There are wider lessons in that incident, which we might come back to, about how you defend networks. So it's helped publicly to be able to talk about that. But it's China's a different threat actor to Russia, and I think that case shows that. The other two states have been Iran and North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
They have some similarities in that they have, they're both, if you like, they both use cyber weaponry for what you might call sort of asymmetric retaliation. In
mm-hmm.
other words, in less jargon, in less jargony terms, they will do things in the digital environment that they would not be prepared to do in the physical realm.
Realm.
So Iran has, U.S. colleagues have said this, you know, they've attacked and disrupted at times of tension in their own neighborhood and against Western targets. As with all of the hostile countries, there is an espionage aspect to this. But Iran and North Korea have done that sort of retaliatory point. So we agreed with the American attribution of the Sony attack back in, I think, 2014. When that corporation made a film that the regime in North Korea didn't like. But I think more recently, if you stay with North Korea and we go back to WannaCry, the most recent North Korean activity has been largely financial in in its motivation, including WannaCry. I mean, WannaCry was a badly executed attempt to raise money. Those are the sort of four main state actors and their motivations. But I think that whilst those are very serious threats and we need to take care of them, the average citizen, including myself and my private life, is more likely to encounter transnational organized cybercrime. Yep. I think this is a real challenge. I think cybercrime has plenty in common conceptually with more traditional crime, but one area where it can be different, or not always different, is that it is not necessary to set foot in the territory where you're planning to commit the crime, or in any friendly territory. So if you think of global organized crime or global terrorism, eventually if you're going to perpetrate a terrorist attack, or if you're going to do people smuggling, somebody somewhere has to set foot on some territory where if you've got the right intelligence and the right powers and competent law enforcement, as we have highly competent law enforcement here, somebody can make an interdiction of some point of some form.
And sometimes
sometimes in cybercrime you can't do that. Every so often US colleagues have a really, really good operational success with a cyber criminal from outside the West who goes on holiday to somewhere and doesn't come back. But that's I think we would all agree that whilst those are very necessary and very satisfying when they work, they're not the strategic solution. So part of the strategic solution is an increase in defences. I'll come back to that in a minute. People do talk about the risk of cyber terrorism. Our view of the risk of cyber terrorism at the minute is fairly low. International terrorist groups have used the internet for extremely unpleasant and horrific activity, radicalization, propaganda, awful, violent videos and so forth. But in terms of their ability to hurt people through the internet, we would view their capabilities as well short of that. They will do things like, and they have done, they have taken lists of, say, for example, military personnel and posted them online and incited violence against them. But in terms of doing things such as, take out a power supply and so forth, there are very few organizations in the world that are capable of doing that. Anybody can mess around in cyberspace, and anybody can cause a bit of disruption, harm, and intimidation. But to do something sophisticated like that takes money, it takes skills, it takes infrastructure, it takes time. All of which is very hard if you're to build. If you're a stateless terrorist organization that's trying to, for example, evade Western, US-led security forces. So that's why that's why we take that view. I also think it's important to say things like that because, the threat gets over-glamorized sometimes. We want to be really realistic. So if you take, for example, so that's an honest, objective assessment of cyber terrorist capabilities. Now, it could change. The most likely way it could change is that one of the things we worry about is the proliferation of cyber weaponry on the open legal market. And terrorist organizations can get money from all sorts of different sources. So they could buy some of these capabilities potentially, and that's something we need to watch, but it's not happening just yet. But if you go back to the nation state threat, it is important that we're nuanced about the threat because that helps defenders. Russia is an extremely aggressive cyber actor against the UK, but it leaves large sections of our economy and society alone because it's not interested in them. It's important to know that so that we don't invest wasteful
scarce resources
in defending things against the Russians that don't need to be defended against. Chinese threats are different. All the threats are different, and it's important to understand them.
Very good answer. Five Eyes. Obviously, that's a very critical part of how all this functions and how we get great visibility across the world. I'm from Australia, as listeners will know of this podcast, and we've got the ACSE, which I guess is the equivalent of the NCSE. But look, Kieran, if you can give us a rundown of how it works on a general level, the sort of intersharing of information, etc.
I mean, the Five Eyes is a post-Second World War concept across lots of different areas of national security cooperation, but particularly intelligence sharing. And because of the nature of intelligence, you know, one of its most one of the sort of heaviest areas of activity is the signals intelligence agencies and the automatic sharing of data. So it's an extremely powerful aggregate capability, greater than the sum of its greater than the sum of its parts. And it works very well. It's evolved, so all of our agencies have some form of responsibility for security. All of us now have set up cybersecurity centres within the parent organisation, with the exception of the US, which has got, you know, I absolutely understand why that is. It's much bigger. And so I think the rest of us can afford, if you like, one government centre of tech excellence, whereas, you know, if you look at the US system, the NSA are world-class at cyber, the CIA are world-class at cyber, the FBI are world-class at cyber.
They've also got $320 million and quite a big budget.
And also changing machinery of government is much harder in the US system because it's not the Westminster model. So there's all these reasons. And the Five Eyes have always been able to cope with different organizational models and different sort of, you know, policy frameworks and choices. So it's an extremely powerful set of capabilities, and it's an extremely close network of like-minded people with common values, often personal friendships and so on. So, you know, it's absolute backbone of what we do here.
Yeah, and this rises above politics.
You know, where the five countries, I mean, given this goes back to the 1940s, the five countries involved have taken different policy decisions at different times and have had, had their agreements, and sometimes they've had their disagreements.
But it's lasted for that long.
And but these are institutional arrangements about sharing data. I mean, we do have to make sure that we can keep each other's data safe. For example, we have to make sure that we can that we use it responsibly. Where 10 years ago, when I mentioned at the start, we were talking about some of the challenges that the human agencies faced around 10 years ago. Part of that was US concern that intelligence shared with the UK had been disclosed in the British courts. So, and that was a legitimate concern. We worked through it, and a new system, a new Act of Parliament was put in place to address those concerns whilst maintaining the rule of law and the access of people to justice and so forth. So, you know, these things happen, and you work through them. But I think, you know, throughout that period, the determination to keep the alliance going and to make it powerful is undiminished. And I think cybersecurity is a very interesting new dimension of that, and it's a little bit more public. So I think, for example, in last winter in San Francisco at the at an Aspen Security Institute conference, there was a Five Eyes panel that I was on, talking in the open to anybody who was interested in about cybersecurity. We're going to be doing the same at Glasgow for the UK's main cybersecurity conference at the end of April. So cybersecurity is a new and dynamic sort of aspect to the Five Eyes partnership.
Excellent. I would be amiss if I didn't ask whether the National Cybersecurity Centre has any relationship with Italy, on a bilateral relationship, because, hey, I'm an Australian living in Italy.
I mean, we have some contact with our Italian counterparts, probably not as much as I would like. I think that we're very open to, I mean, whatever happens with the final form of the UK's future relationship with the EU.
Waiting with bated breath.
The Prime Minister and all the Cabinet have been clear that security cooperation is unconditional. So we've got, you know, I was in Brussels last month, lots of very, very good discussions with the EU as a set of institutions, but also with individual member states. You know, our door is open. We've done huge amounts with EU member states on, for example, electoral security, which is something everybody's interested in now. We've had a huge seminar last year, I think it may have been 2017, with 20 of the EU member states represented on electoral security. We have very, very good relationships with individual member states, but certainly if anyone from the Italian cybersecurity authorities are listening, then we'd be very keen to deepen the partnership further.
Fantastic. And look, I could continue for hours talking, and because I'm thoroughly enjoying listening. Plenty of great information, but I think we're going to have to start wrapping up quite soon. So maybe if we can just indicate what the future holds for the NCSC, where people can find you, activities that you're running, and then we can wrap up.
Well, thank you. So find us online at ncsc.gov.uk or at NCSC on Twitter. We've got lots of really interesting activities, so particularly around the skills agenda. There are by, as you would expect, UK-focused. But what's really interesting, you know, we've always had a remit in trying to develop elite cybersecurity skills. And again, that brings us way out into the open, trying to search out new talent. And we started off intervening in very traditional areas about why don't we fund some cybersecurity PhDs.
Okay.
Learning from that, we said, hang on, any interventions have to be much, much earlier in the education system. Because by the time you get to PhD level, you know, everyone's filtered themselves out and so forth. Particularly, sadly, most of the female population. So we're doing some really interesting things. Next weekend, I'm going to Edinburgh for the final of the Cyber First Girls competition.
Yep.
So that's...
And how old, what's the age?
12 to 13. And that's 8,000 girls taking part. Or took part up to this will be the 10 finalists. Really, really strong skills. And what we're learning from that, because we keep in touch with all the finalists, subject to, you know, parental and school permission. You know, we keep developing them. You get into this community. You build a community of interest. You sustain those girls' interest in technology subjects and so on. So there's a whole bunch of activity around skills. Where we want to go strategically with the NCSC as a whole, I would say I've got, I think there are two things we're always going to have to be able to do. And there are three things that we need to do more of. So the two things that, you know, this organization just has to be able to do all the time is react quickly and authoritatively to any incident. You know, some things happen and things will continue to happen. The internet is a fundamentally insecure construct.
Dynamic place,
And things will happen on it, and we've got to be ready for that. And that's all the way through from, you know, detecting who it is through to saying to the British population, there's been an attack. This is who it affects. This is the risks you're running. Here's what you can do to mitigate those risks. So that's the first thing we have to be able to do all the time. And the second thing is that, and it feeds into that, is we need to have a world-class detection and knowledge base as part of GCHQ that feeds into that. We have to know things and be able to do things that only the government lawfully can. So maintaining those two sorts of sets of core capabilities are absolutely critical. The three things I want to do more of, though, so the first is... the first we've sort of covered.
Yep.
I would like, by the end of next year, I would like the average citizen to have heard more about us and to know more about basic cybersecurity.
Yeah.
Cybersecurity is attritional. If everyone makes themselves that little bit safer, the problem doesn't go away, but it's reduced because you make your attackers work a little bit harder.
Yeah.
And far too many of the attacks that we see just exploit those basic weaknesses. The Chinese attribution we talked about it came from a group that is known in the industry as APT-10. The attack that we uncovered, APT, as you know, stands for Advanced Persistent Threat. The attack was not advanced, it was not persistent, and they weren't particularly threatening. It was weak cybersecurity, so we just have to make sure that individuals, whether it's individuals in their own lives or just, you know, people operating in their professional lives, just understand this a bit better. The second thing is, I think that, you know, over the long term, we have an opportunity to fix some of our most vulnerable systems. Legacy IT, as everyone knows, is very hard to fix because it's disruptive and costly to retrofit security onto it. Sometimes it's not even possible. So as systems are replenished, we've got to get in there at the critical national infrastructure. And I think the third and the most exciting thing is the unseen bit about improving what we might call the cybersecurity ecosystem, or improving the digital ecosystem. So I've said repeatedly that the internet is unsafe, but we've talked about some of the flaws. You know, why does nobody have an incentive to stop spoofing? How can you just... we know so much about malicious code. Can we block it in a way that doesn't interfere with people's liberties? We've done that on government networks. Can we roll that out? So we've had a whole series of really, really interesting... but largely, but often sort of small scale proof of concept innovations that we've largely confined to government networks because we, you know, because the government controls those. No, people don't have to work for the government, so there's no sort of civil liberties dimension to it, and that's a good testing area. But ultimately, you know, could the UK, through our work with our partners, with some of that innovation, could it become, while still remaining a free and open internet society, could it become an automatically safer one as well at scale? So can you scale that out?
Sure.
So last week, for example, we've got what we call a protective DNS service. And the DNS, as you know, is the address book of the internet. We've got a whole data set of bad destinations on the internet. With voluntarily participating government organisations, of which there are over 600 now, we protect automatically. So if you click on a dodgy link, and I did myself when reading a US politics website, it just says, sorry, the National Cybersecurity Center says you can't go here. Not because we think the content's inappropriate, but we believe it to be malicious. Last week, in the 600 plus organizations that we protect, we checked over 4 billion attempts to connect to a particular internet destination. We blocked 1 million potentially malicious connections, and we believe
4 billion over how long, sorry?
Over a week.
Over a week.
Right. We blocked 1 million, just over a million likely malicious destinations, and we believe that that prevented what would have been 1,200 cybersecurity events, if you like, cybersecurity incidents, cybersecurity malicious happenings.
Wow.
And that's on 600 relatively small government authorities.
Yeah.
Scale that
just
up.
Just imagine the scale.
Scale that up and make that work in a way that's consistent with a free and safer internet, and think of the potential of what we can do there.
Absolutely. Well, I think we'll end there on the potential of what you've already done. So, Kieran, thank you so much. It's been incredibly descriptive and insightful. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Nick.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.